Thank you for joining me for another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. We are going to return to the story in 1 Samuel chapter 30, which is part of the story of the Battle of Mount Gilboa, where King Saul is killed, which opens up then the opportunity for David to become the king of Israel as he was anointed to be. Timing-wise, we're talking about probably the late summer, early fall of 1017 BC. It's the 20th year of King Saul, and looks like about the 440th year of the Exodus. These things start kind of falling into place as we come into the details of David's reign. Now, this is what we know so far. The Philistines move into the Jezreel Valley up in the north. David is with them to begin with. But 5 days before the battle, as the Philistines are actually getting ready to move from Aphek, which is at the western entry point to the Jezreel Valley, to Shunem, which is in the central part of the northern Jezreel Valley, four of the Philistine kings say, "What's that Hebrew doing here?" And of course, Achish, the king of Gath, said, "Well, he's my bodyguard. He's been living with me for the last couple of years. I've found him very trustworthy. And he's going to fight with us." And they say, "By no means. This is David. This is the enemy. This is the guy that killed Goliath that they've been singing about all these years. Yes, he's on the outs with King Saul, but what better way to get back in Saul's good graces than to wait until the battle starts and then attack us from behind? Make him go away." So even though Achish wanted David to be there, he is overruled by the other four Philistine commanders, and David has to leave to head back to Ziklag the next morning. So that's 4 days before the battle. David starts a 3-day trip southward. Now, meanwhile, Saul is over in the mountains of Gilboa, which is a ridgeline. It's the transition point from the hill country of southern part of Israel down into the very eastern end of the Jezreel Valley. And he has his soldiers there, but he's also got some forward elements down in the Jezreel Valley, just a mile or so east of Jezreel City, there at the waters form the spring there. And the Philistines are going to be setting up just northwest of there, about 4 miles. And so the battle lines are starting to be drawn up here about 4 days before the battle. And Saul can see that he's in trouble. This is a big invasion by the Philistines, and God won't talk to him. And he has no prophets that he trusts to tell him the word of God. And so he decided he's got to find someone that can tap into the spirit world on his behalf. And of course, he's already run out of legitimate society, all of the necromancers, all of the mediums, the people who involved themselves in the occult arts, they've kind of been driven underground. So he's got the call out there with his most intimate people: find me a medium. Find me someone that can reach into the spirit world. So that's going on as well. But David, after 3 days, ends up at Ziklag. So that means he arrives 2 days before the battle of Mount Gilboa. He is a long ways away from King Saul. This is very important. I will stress this multiple times. It is important for him to not be anywhere near where King Saul dies. To make it very clear, he was not involved in a coup. It'll be very important to the story. Now, where's he at? He's back at Ziklag, which belongs to the Gath territory. It's south of Gath, in the northern part of the Negev, the southern desert of Judah. And it says in chapter 30, and this is a review for us, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, that is the third day since they left the Jezreel Valley, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. The Amalekites are notorious kidnappers and slave traders. David has been carrying out military operations against them recently. And so it's a little bit ironic. Possibly it's retributive. They're getting retribution against David by coming to Ziklag while he was away and capturing all of his non-combatants. Verse 3, when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire. Their wives, their sons, their daughters are taken captive. David, the people who were with him, raised their voices. They wept until they had no more strength to weep. And you can appreciate that. What grief is involved. David's two wives had also been taken captive. Ahinoam of Jezreel, Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. So he's married these two women in the last few months while he was on the run from King Saul. And now here he has set up shop at Jezreel. Ziklag. Jezreel that's mentioned here as the city of Ahinoam. That's not the Jezreel Valley up north. That's a Jezreel in Judah territory. And Carmel is also in Judah territory in this context. Verse 6, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. So they want to kill David. They want to execute David because it's all his fault. That's the thinking. But David strengthened himself in he who is his God. And then he reaches out to God for direction. This is appropriate procedure here for him. David said to Abiathar the priest, a young man, the only one of the priestly line that escaped in the massacre of Nob. He's the son of Ahimelech. And he said, bring me the ephod. The ephod is the special uniform of the high priest, the part that has the 12 stone chest piece on it. And then behind that is the pocket where the Urim and the Thummim are. And that's what David is after. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. He's probably wearing it. David inquired of he who is, shall I pursue after this band? That's a yes or no question. Shall I overtake them? Another yes or no question. And God's response through the Urim and the Thummim, which you've heard me repeat, I believe in the traditional Jewish understanding that one of the stones glowed miraculously in answer to the question. And that's how the answer was divined. So God answered, pursue. So yes, you shall pursue them. Yes, you shall overtake them. And you shall surely rescue. So David set out. He had 600 men who were with him. We've heard about these 600 men before. And they are heading south. As I told you, we don't know exactly where Ziklag is, but it's south of Gath. Now we find out that it's north of the Besor River. Now, the Besor drains the watershed that Beersheba rests upon. And that means that it's part of the ancient region of Geshur. And so they come to the Besor River, where those who were left behind stayed, because he's got 200 that we're told are too exhausted to cross the brook Besor. And not surprising, they have already been traveling 3 days when they arrived at Ziklag and found that it had been raided. And then they pushed out again, heading even farther south. And so some of these guys, they just can't do it. They are done. And so David can only pursue with 400 men. The other 200 hang out in this camp by the Besor River, keeping track of supplies. Verse 11, as they continue traveling south, they found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David. So out here in the middle of nowhere, they find this guy that is ethnically Egyptian. Turns out that he's probably a slave that was captured or bought by these Amalekites. Remember, they are slave traders. And he is dying of thirst and starvation. So they gave him bread and he ate. They gave him water to drink. They gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived. So this makes a big difference because he had not eaten bread or drunk wine for 3 days and three nights. Now that is an interesting use of that terminology, which shows up in the later story of Jesus' death and resurrection. Because when we piece all of the chronology together here in this passage, we find out that it is not a literal 3 days and three nights since the raid at Ziklag. And yet the terminology is used here. So it seems to be idiomatic. And that's what I believe was the case in the New Testament use of it. It's similar, I often say, to when we say, "Oh, I spent the whole weekend at my parents' house." And then when you drill down, you find out that the person was not there until Saturday morning, and they came back Sunday afternoon. Well, that's not literally the entire weekend, but it is used idiomatically. That's true in Hebrew for different phrases, just like it is in English. So back to the story here. David said to this guy that they've just rescued, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" And he said, "I'm a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. My master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago." So the day on which they were raiding Ziklag, this guy became gravely ill. And it was obvious that he was not going to be able to travel, but his master didn't want to hang around and wait for him to feel better. So he basically writes him off, just dumps him in the desert with no supplies and figures that, oh, well, I'm out one slave, but it's more important we keep traveling. That's the way some people feel about slaves. Verse 14, "We'd made a raid against the Negeb of the Gerethites and against that which belongs to Judah and against the Negeb of Caleb." All the region south of Hebron is called the Negeb of Caleb because Caleb was the most famous person who moved into this area at the time of Israel entering into the land. And listen to this, "We burn Ziklag with fire." Now, David would be interested in the other things, but this is the most important thing to him. This guy has just told him, I was in the raiding party. I was a slave to one of the Amalekites leading the raiding party that burnt Ziklag. So David said to him, will you take me down to this band? So will you show me, indicate to me where these guys were headed? And he said, swear to me by God that you'll not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master. I'll take you down to this band. So he seems to be worried about two things. That David and his men might kill him because he was in the raiding party, even though he was a slave. So he wants consideration from them that he won't be held accountable, which they give him. And he also wants to make sure that there won't be made a deal with the Amalekites to get, you know, their people back by giving this guy over to them after he's provided information as to where they would be, because more than likely he'd end up dead because of that. So they give him that promise as well. And so when he had taken him down, a little bit farther south evidently, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the spoil they'd taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. So David, thanks to this slave, comes upon this sprawled out encampment of the Amalekites, and they're just partying because they think they've gotten far enough away now that they don't need to worry about any pursuit forces. After all, they are probably well aware that the Philistines and many of the Judeans who are part of the army of Israel, they're way up north in Jezreel, a few days to the north. And so there's no way in the world anybody's going to be chasing them down before they get back to their hometown. So they've decided to party. David takes advantage of their drunken and unprepared state and attacks them. So David struck them down from twilight. The twilight that's mentioned here appears to mean the time after the sun has gotten past the mid-afternoon point, but before it hits the horizon. So for our practical purposes, let's just say between 3 and 6 p.m. So in that period, that's the twilight of the day. It's the decline of the day. And he kept attacking them until the evening of the following day. Remember that Jewish days start at sunset. And so the evening, the night, begins when the sun drops below the horizon. So from late afternoon into the early hours of darkness of that same night, from our perspective, that covers 2 days on a Jewish perspective. David and his men are attacking several hours, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. So when David and his guys sweep into this sprawling encampment, there were apparently 400 guys that were quick enough to jump on some camels and take off, that they didn't end up paying the penalty of death for being part of this kidnap band. Verse 18, David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken. David rescued his 2 wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil, or anything that had been taken. And David brought all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him, and they said, this is David's spoil. So not only did he get his own people from Ziklag, he's got other people and other properties from other places. The things that belong to Israelis, I am certain that David would intend to restore them to the Israelis. The things that might have been captured from Philistines, he'll probably consider that the spoils of war. So that happens in the evening, and then they probably sleep. Then the next morning, they get up, and they head north to Ziklag. So David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor. And so that means that we've just seen David beat the Amalekites on the day before the battle of Mount Gilboa, way up to the north. And now it's the morning after, which is the morning of the battle. And David is coming back to his 200 men at the Wadi or the river Besor. Let's leave them there, because now we need to go back and pick up the story that we left unfinished about King Saul back in chapter 28. And that is when Saul, this is 28 verse number 5. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. That was probably a few days earlier, before the battle. And when Saul inquired of he who is did not answer him either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. And so Saul said to his servants at that time, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." So he tells his most trusted servants, "Find me a medium." And after a few days' time, and it turns out to be the night before the battle of Mount Gilboa, they find this woman and bring King Saul to her covertly, incognito. His servants said to him, "Behold, there is a medium at En-Dor." Now, I think there's a little bit of confusion in some of the commentaries as to where this En-Dor is. It is not on the north side of the Jezreel Valley, which is where I've seen it placed by some mappers, because that's behind Philistine lines. That doesn't make any sense. I believe it is on the south side of the Jezreel Valley, up in the hilly area, probably to the southwest of where King Saul's troops are bivouacked on Mount Gilboa and down at the waters near the city of Jezreel. So it's just a few miles from his base camp. So verse 8, Saul disguised himself. He put on other garments, and he went, he and two men with him. They came to the woman by night. So this is the same night that David is fighting the Amalekites several days' travel to the south. Saul is quietly and covertly meeting with an occultic worker on the edge of the Jezreel Valley. And this is what he asks. He said, "Divine for me by a spirit, and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you." Now, the way that these things used to work, and if you do any research, you find out that they still kind of do it this way today. The medium has what's referred to as a familiar spirit. They already have a relationship with a spiritual being on the other side of the dividing point between our dimension and the unseen world. And they use that relationship to reach out into the spirit world farther to supposedly find dead persons. Now, it's all a big con game. The dead do not speak to the living. The spirits that are in that region are the fallen angels, the demonic beings that hate mankind, and they're running a long-term con on mankind. And they got a lot of information so they can play this con very well. And so the idea would be, though, that she would say, okay, who do you want to meet with? Who do you want to hear from? And I'll send my spirit out there to meet with them. And then she talks back and forth between the two. She becomes like the intercessor. Saul doesn't actually hear the voice of the being that he wants to talk to. He hears her voice. But something weird happens here. First, she says, surely you know what Saul has done, how he's cut off mediums and the necromancers from the land. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death? So she says, come on, you know that King Saul has outlawed, under penalty of death, doing anything like what you're asking me to do. Are you trying to get me killed? And Saul, who has not introduced himself as Saul, he swore to her by he who is, which is really weird, that he's talking to a woman that's violating the law of God by swearing in the name of that God that he won't carry out the rules of that law. So Saul swore to her by he who is, as he who is lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. So he makes an oath before witnesses that he will not let anyone know that she's violating the law. And so she then agrees and she says, who do you want me to get in touch for? And he said, I need you to bring Samuel for me. We'll come into that story the next time we're into the Word.